The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello and welcome to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. This is Richard Palmer standing in for your regular host, Stephen Flurry. Now, we've talked a fair bit about the German elections on this show, but I want to give you a bit of an update today on how things are going, on some of the latest news on coalition negotiations, and also bring out another very important factor in the German elections that's not been discussed, I don't think, much at all in the media. Really, a very stunning fact about the German elections that has been all but ignored. We'll also talk later today about an existential crisis for Spain, some major, major trouble that's brewing over there. But first, these German elections. One of the big questions after the election has been, when is Germany going to get its next government? And we've talked about how it could take months. Now, there's certainly a lot of precedent for it taking a very long time. Germany is being hit now with exactly the same trend that has been sweeping all of Europe. The Dutch held an election on March 15th. They were in a similar boat to Germany. The election was fragmented. There were lots of smaller parties. Lots of people voting for Geert Wilders' party over there, which was kind of outside of the mainstream, one that mainstream parties were reluctant to work with. Now, so that vote was on March 15th. 4 months later, on July 21st, the Dutch still did not have a government. And at that point, that became the longest Dutch coalition negotiations in 40 years. 40 years. That was on July 21st. But what's more amazing is the Dutch still do not have a government. Even today, there is no Dutch government. They've not been able to put together a coalition. It's been 6 months from the Dutch election, and you may remember we had quite a lot of coverage on this show at the time. We were talking about many of the same things that we're talking about now with the German elections. Still no government. Now, when it comes to this, they're amateurs compared to their southern neighbours. Belgium holds the record for the longest period with no government. I don't know whether these long negotiations are part of some kind of rivalry between these two countries, whether the Dutch are now going for the Belgian record. But Belgium set the record for the longest period with no government for a modern developed country at 589 days. 589 days. Now, these countries, they could go along without having a government and not have too big of an impact on the world. I saw a few articles, even with the Belgian situation, where people were saying, well, actually, we're getting along better with no government than we were with a government. Maybe we should just always have no government. Sorry for Belgian or Dutch listeners, but these aren't hugely crucial countries. The world isn't kind of hanging on every word of the Belgian prime minister. And so they were able to get along in those situations. But now Germany is now becoming one of those countries with these long coalition negotiations and these unstable governments. That's really the direction it's heading in, and that's dangerous for all of Europe. Spiegel had an article yesterday in German where they were reporting that basically Merkel's kind of old government don't think that there's going to be a new coalition agreement in place until next year. 2018, we're looking at, they're expecting next 4 months, no government, at least. That's what we've got forming in Germany. The reason why this came up in Spiegel is that under German law, they have to extend their military missions every year. So for German troops to remain abroad, Parliament has to sign off on it. It's mostly a formality. Normally, the ruling government coalition has more than enough votes to get those through the parliament, but they review it, they make changes, and that's scheduled to happen in December. And according to reports, the German kind of the old German, outgoing German defense minister. I don't know whether she'll remain in place. Ursula von der Leyen wanted a big increase to the German deployment in Afghanistan, for example. She wanted another 500 troops there to up that to around 1,500. But what Spiegel reports, based on an anonymous government source, is that officials don't think they're going to have a coalition in place by December. So instead of presenting a new plan for German troops, they just want to put in an extension to keep things as they are for another 3 months. And they're going to have that before Parliament in October. That's what they're planning, to kind of put a sticky plaster on the situation, because they don't think they'll have a government by the end of the year. Now think about what that means. Germany, potentially with no government until at some point in 2018. How much has been happening in Europe, in the world, over the last few months? Look at the pace that world events are leading at. And we'll talk about one of the potential crises that could be confronting Europe in the second half. And now we could be in the position where the German government is just kind of with a ticking over, with placeholders in place, unable to really react, unable to make big decisions. And the coalition negotiations look really tough. I do sometimes wonder whether they're going to be able to get a government together at all. And I think we could well end up in the unprecedented situation for Germany where they can't get a coalition together. And if that happens, well, it's just going to make things drag on further. And then you would end up ultimately, eventually having fresh elections and then more coalition negotiations after that. If you start going down that road, you can easily see Germany without a government for 6-9 months. What is that going to be like just in this unstable world? Germany leaderless like that. And so, as I said, I think these negotiations could be really tough. For those of you not familiar maybe with some of the parties, the German parties, and how this could play out, I thought I'd give a bit of an intro to German politics and recap what some of these coalition negotiations look like. So really, there's about six, seven main German parties that you need to be familiar with. Obviously, the biggest are the CDU and the SDP. The CDU, the Christian Democratic Union, is the main right-wing German party. So in some ways, the German equivalent of the Republicans. And then the SDP, the Social Democratic Party, is the main left-wing German party. And you could consider those the German equivalent of the Democrats. Now, the CDU work in partnership with another party called the CSU, the Christian Social Union. And they're sometimes called the sister parties. Sometimes that's why you'll sometimes hear me talking about the Christian Union parties. The way that works is the Christian Social Union only operates in Bavaria. Bavaria is a bit like Germany's Texas. It's a big region with a large economy that's also a bit more independent from the rest of Germany. And so the CSU only operates there, and then the CDU does not operate in Bavaria. It operates everywhere else in Germany. And so the two of them work together. The CSU typically supports the CDU in government. The CSU typically supports the CDU chancellor. Sometimes the CDU supports a CSU chancellor, and the two of them work together and support someone from the CSU for a government position. So it's kind of a bit of a complicated relationship. They're close, but they're definitely not the same. And this relationship is really coming under strain. The CSU tends to be much more conservative, or more conservative than the CDU, also more religious. The CDU especially is kind of, Christian is in the name, but it's not really much elsewhere in the party apart from in the name. The CSU sticks much more to puts much more of a focus on that Christian element, talking about family matters and this kind of thing from more of a Christian perspective. And Bavaria is much more of a Catholic part of Europe, and so the Catholic Church is much more of a stronger influence with the CSU. That's why you will see CSU leaders meeting with the Pope probably more commonly than you would see even German chancellors meeting with the Pope and religious leaders there. So those are the main right and left-wing parties. Then you've got this new party kind of on the further right, the Alternative for Deutschland. And they're brand new. The other parties have said that they're not going to work with them, that they're too extreme. Inside the AfD itself, though, really is a whole spectrum of different views. It was originally founded by a bunch of economists to try and get Germany out of the euro. Now, its main founder ended up quitting the party, Bernard Lucke. He didn't like the direction that it was taking. So it's become kind of anti-immigrant, and there's some, I think, that are getting at least very close to being neo-Nazi in that party. And there are other people that are more like, you know, say, conservative commentators that we would quote on this show. So quite a broad spectrum there within the Alternative for Deutschland. At the other extreme, you have Die Linke, or the Left Party. And we're going to talk a bit more about them soon. They're a very important party, but they're on the far left of the spectrum. They're the successor party to the Communist Party that ruled East Germany. And again, they're kind of so extreme that at least on the national level, the mainstream parties have said, we're not going to work with the Left Party. So you've got the AfD on the right, the Die Linke on the left. They're both considered so extreme that the mainstream parties won't work with them. And that's part of what makes these coalition negotiations so complicated. If you've got a big chunk of votes on the left and on the right that no party will work with, that makes it harder to build a right-wing coalition or a left-wing coalition. So you've got those. Also on the right, you have what the FDP, the Free Democratic Party. And they're a pro-business free market party, economically conservative, generally also socially liberal. And when they've been in coalition in the past, I think their leader was a homosexual. But they're an economic conservative, so they're generally considered on the right. And then finally, you've got the Green Party. They're further left, as you can imagine, than the Social Democrats. They're much more about environmentalism. And they typically go in coalition, the FDP, the Free Democrats, typically go in coalition with the CDU and the CSU, whereas the Green Party typically go in coalition with the SDP, the Social Democrats, the centre-left party. Now, the SDP, in the last election, you had the CDU and SDP with a coalition. The main left-wing party and the main right-wing party came together and formed a coalition. And that was complicated. In fact, that coalition negotiation set the record for the longest ever German coalition negotiation. It took 3 months to get it all together. And that was just two parties. So I think that gives you a sense of how hard these upcoming coalition negotiations are going to be, because the SDP have said that they don't want to be in coalition this time. After their last experience in coalition, they got massacred at the ballot box. It was a disastrous election for them, the worst election, their worst showing in post-war history. So understandably, they're saying, well, we don't want to be in coalition. We would much rather sit in opposition. So they've ruled out being in coalition. We'll see if that remains, but that's the way it is for now. So that leaves only one viable option that could get a majority, excluding working with these parties that people have said we're not going to work with. And that would be a coalition between the CDU and CSU, and then also the Free Democrats and the Greens. And as we've talked about, that's known as the Jamaica Coalition. It's something that could well be unstable. On an earlier show, I think it was on Tuesday, Mr. Flurry played a clip from Carl Theodor zu Guttenberg talking about this coalition negotiation. I thought he made some great points. So we'll play that clip again quickly now.
But what does that mean then when it comes to coalition building? It obviously makes it that much harder for Chancellor Merkel. We're hearing about the Jamaica coalition that will take in the Greens and the FDP. They're very far apart when it comes to policy stances. How is she going to bring those together to actually form a functioning and long-lasting government?
Right. Imagine Jamaica in Germany, which is already it's an intellectual task. But it means not only forming a coalition with two parties she has not dealt with together. It's the first time in Germany that we don't have a two-party coalition, but a three-party plus one coalition, because what's also underestimated is that her sister party, the CSU, is not a twin, is not a party that will make life easier for her in the next few months.
She needs to make concessions with them.
She'll need to make concessions with the Greens. She'll make first time coaling with them. She'll have to make concessions with the FDP, who are in a state now that they can spell self-confidence correctly. So the coalition talks will be extremely complicated. I still expect her to form a coalition, and I don't see new elections on the horizon.
So extremely complicated negotiations. And you can see why they'll be tough. Just to show that, think about some of the contradictory party stances. So ahead of the elections, the Green Party leader said, the Greens won't enter any coalition that doesn't initiate the end of the combustion engine. Apparently the Greens aren't against double negatives, but to simplify that a little, he's saying we're only going to enter government if it initiates the end of the internal combustion engine, We're completely against the petrol engine. We want to phase it out. Actually, it's in their platform. They want to ban the internal combustion engine by 2030. They want to stop manufacturing petrol and diesel cars. So that's the Greens. At the other end of the spectrum, the FDP, the Free Democratic leader, said a witch hunt has been started against diesel and the whole car industry. And the Green Party campaigned, so the Green Party campaigned on destroying petrol and diesel engines, and the FDP party campaigned on being the savior of Germany's petrol and diesel car engines and industry. And Ms. Merkel's got to try and get these two to work together. Then you've got the Green Party says that they want subsidies for renewable energy. The FDP's election platform says renewable energy should play by the rules of the market in the future with all the chances and risks that entails. So Green Party manifesto, subsidy for renewable energy. FDP Party manifesto, end subsidies for renewable energy. The FDP Party promised to cut taxes by 30 million euros a year. The Green Party said they would raise taxes on the top rate of income tax. Just absolutely contradictory manifestos. Ambrose Evan Pritchard had an article in The Telegraph earlier this week where he wrote, the Greens and the FDP hurled invective at each other through the election. It may take months for Ms. Merkel to bind these ideological foes together, if it can be done at all. Firstly, Zu Gutenberg thinks it can be done, and he's really an expert on these kind of things, as someone who's participated in German government and coalition talks and things like that. But I mean, certainly for me, looking at this, I find it hard to imagine that some of these parties getting together, and it's certainly not going to be easy. It's certainly not going to be a stable coalition. Robert Halver from Beta Bank, he said it's easier to herd a sack of mosquitoes. And that's just these two parties, the Greens and the FDP. As you heard from Zu Gutenberg, you've got to get the Christian Social Union in there, and they're going to be playing tough. They just saw the AfD come along and eat a good portion of their lunch, and they want to be winning those votes back on the right. Now, the Green Party, though, they've set out red lines on immigration. They published, before the election, they published a list of things, and they said, oh, these things are the minimum that have to be met for us to enter a coalition. That's our promise to our voters. We're not going to agree to a coalition without these things. And so they said, for example, well, for us to enter a government, family members must be allowed to come from Syria, Iraq, from elsewhere, and join the migrants, their family members that are migrants that have already entered Germany. So if somebody in this big wave of refugees came to Germany, they want now that person to be able to invite their family members, their parents, siblings, possibly even grandparents, aunts and uncles to come into Germany from Syria, from Iraq, from wherever. And the Green Party saying, well, they need to be able to take the rest of their family in. Meanwhile, the Christian Social Union is dead against that. They're much more anti-immigration than Angela Merkel. And again, they're worried about the AfD. And you know, typically, family members are allowed to join existing family members in Germany. But after the migrant crisis, they put that on hold. They kind of kicked the can down the road saying, well, we'll deal with that in 2 years. So in 2018, they're going to have to look at that. And usually their family members would be able to join them in 2018, but the AfD are dead against, as I said, CSU are dead against that. But one member of Angela Merkel's party earlier said that he expected over 1 million people to come into Germany as family members of migrants. So if it goes through and if the Greens get their demand, well, that could mean 1 million more migrants for Germany. Can you imagine what that would mean for Germany? You know, we saw what 1 million migrants just in general did for Germany in their politics. Can you imagine what 1 million more would do? And the CSU is going to fight that tooth and nail. So getting that coalition, to get part of the coalition together is going to be really hard. And then there's the migrant cap. The Greens have put that as a red line. We're not going to join the government if they put a cap on the number of migrants that come into the Germany. The CSU are pushing hard for a migrant cap, and they want that to be a red line. They're talking about making that a red line, saying, well, we won't enter government if there is not a migrant cap. So this is going to be tough. And remember, the majority of Green Party members have said that they'd rather not join or Green Party voters have said they'd rather the party didn't join a coalition. And the Green Party, you know, they saw what happened to the Social Democrats. They made compromises to join the government. and they got hammered at the election. The election before, the Free Democrats made compromises to join the election. I mean, to join the government, they got hammered so hard at the election that they had no MPs in Parliament. So the Green Party, looking at all of that, they're not going to be in a mood to compromise. They're probably looking at that and thinking, well, electorally, it will probably be better for us to sit this one out rather than compromise on these core points that we've promised the German government that we're going to do. I mean, that we promised our voters that we're not going to compromise on. So you can see why this could be a long, long process. Why the kind of old government officials, the officials from the last government, are thinking, well, we're not going to be able to get this done until 2018. You can see why this is leading to a paralyzed Germany. But what does this mean? Where is this ultimately leading? Well, to look at that, I want to zoom in, or to get a sense for that, zoom in on results in one part of Germany, and that is East Germany. The results from East Germany are shocking. And I don't think I've seen, apart from one at the aspect of the Alternative for Deutschland, I've not really seen people talk about this. But in the East, the Alternative for Deutschland, they did even better. They were the second largest party with 22.5% of the vote. So one in five in the East voted for this party, where one of their leaders said, we have a right to be proud of what our soldiers accomplished during World War II. One in five. And then the party that came in third, well, it was not the mainstream Social Democrats, the mainstream left party. It was not even the Greens, this slightly more left-wing party. It was Die Linke, this far-left party, this party that's the successor of the, you know, the communist government of East Germany that ran the Stasi, that, you know, the secret police that caused millions to live in fear. Well, Die Linke, and they won 17.4%. So put those together in East Germany, 40% voted for these extreme parties. That's just shocking. Like I said, the left party, they're probably more extreme left than the AfD is right. Some of its members are under government surveillance because the government fears they want to overthrow the state. In Bavaria, the entire party is under government surveillance. They're the successor of the Socialist Union Party that ran the Stasi secret police. They backed the Soviet Union, but that empire that slips in just behind Mao's China is on the list of most murderous regimes in all of history, even beating Adolf Hitler. And the left party, they want to end NATO. They want to end big business. They bring busts of Karl Marx on campaign with them. The left-leaning Economist magazine, they had one of their columnists go and interview one of the left party leaders. And after that, he said, I found myself praying that these people never get anywhere near power. And that's from the Economist. Until 2014, no mainstream party would form a coalition with the left. They were too much of a pariah. But then they started surging in popularity. And so then the Social Democrats and the Greens, they did form a coalition on a regional level, but the SDP has constantly promised they will not form a coalition with the left party on the national level. But 40%, nearly half in East Germany, voted for one of these two parties. That's a lot of anger. That's a lot of dissatisfaction in East Germany with the way the country is being run. And that level of dissatisfaction, that level of people voting for these pariah parties, well, that leads to this political paralysis that we're seeing, which then leads to yet more dissatisfaction. This is exactly what we saw in the run-up to World War II. In the 1930s, you had these same kind of upstart parties, both on the left and on the right. We tend to focus on the extreme right parties, but there were extreme left parties in the 1930s rising up quickly as well. And both mainstream parties refused to work with either of these. But then, just like today, it meant that the mainstream parties didn't have enough votes to form their easy coalitions. You couldn't have a simple coalition of right-wing parties or a simple coalition of left-wing parties anymore unless you brought some of these extreme ones in. And so what happened? Well, it meant you had minority governments that were very unstable. You had coalitions between the left and the right wing where people had to make massive compromises, which angered their voters and led to very unstable governments. And so you had these voters getting more angry, governments unstable, elections coming around again. And so then these angry voters voted for, even in greater numbers, for these extreme parties because they were disappointed with the mainstream ones. That made it even harder to form coalitions. It made the coalitions even more ineffective. It then pushed more people towards the extreme parties. It leads to this cycle. And eventually, either these extreme parties were invited into government like they were in Nazi Germany, or they would just try and take over, as they did in some places in Eastern Europe. And just the entire system of democracy became dysfunctional. And eventually, in the 1930s, people ended up not just questioning the political parties, but questioning democracy itself. And this result in East Germany, where 40% voted for these extreme parties, well, they hint that this could get a lot worse in Germany. How do you form a government when, say, 40% of the voters vote for one of these extreme parties? It makes it almost impossible to have any kind of workable coalition. So Germany is set for paralysis. If it gets a coalition together, it's going to be very unstable. You know, a house divided against itself cannot stand. And look at those divided, how divided that coalition is going to be if it comes together. One party wanting to kill the internal combustion engine, one party trying to be the savior of the German petrol and diesel industry. And then people are getting angry. This trend is not going away. So why are we watching this? Why is the Trumpet so interested in the minutiae of German politics, say? Well, the Bible prophesies some big changes here, and it has some prophecies that bear directly on German politics. The Bible gives us some very clear hints about what the political makeup of Europe. We'll have a look at some of these in Daniel chapter 8, because it really does talk. I mean, we'll play some quotes, even some sound bites of things that we've said 10 years ago, based on what is said in these scriptures that we're about to look at, that really accurately predict exactly the situation that you've got in Germany, saying, watch for exactly this kind of a situation, because it could well bring about what is prophesied here in Daniel chapter 8. Just in verse 17, it says at the end of that verse, understand, O son of man, for at the time of the end shall be the vision. So these are prophecies for the end, for the time that we're living in right now. And we'll look at Daniel chapter 8 and verse 23. And in the latter time, again, for the time of the end, the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressors are come to the full, a king of fierce countenance and understanding dark sentences shall stand up. So a king. This is the leader that's prophesied to come on the scene in Europe. Now, in Daniel chapter 8, it's a long prophecy to Daniel. Some of it has already been fulfilled. It prophesies a lot of what would happen in ancient history. It was prophesied to Daniel during the Persian Empire. It prophesies of things like Alexander the Great, and then what would happen to him and those that came in the scene after him. And that's already been fulfilled. It's already happened. So many of these verses in Daniel chapter 8 have already been proven. So we can rely on this. And it says at the time of the end, there's going to be this king. Where will this king be? Well, we'll look at another prophecy that shows that this king will be in this power called the King of the North later. And that prophecy talks about, even this prophecy talks about this king fighting Israel, modern Israel being America and Britain. It also talks in Daniel chapter 11 about this king fighting kings from the east. So that rules out Russia and China. This king can't be referring to a leader in Russia or China because there is no one to Russia and China's east. There's just sea. But then Habakkuk chapter 1, the book of Isaiah, others talk about Assyria having a fierce king, just like what's described in Daniel chapter 8. So this is talking about Assyria, modern Germany. That's where this king will be. In our free booklet, A Strong German Leader is Imminent, Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry writes, this soon coming ruler could literally be called a king. Even if he's not, the Bible gives him that label. When the Bible talks about a king, in most cases, it is saying that this is not a democratic government. Even if he doesn't have that title, he is going to lead like a king. This vision in Daniel shows that the European Empire is about to become a lot more authoritative. So that's why we're keenly watching this in Germany. When you see this, the democratic politics become dysfunctional. And we've seen what happens after democracies become dysfunctional in the past. In the 1930s, it led to dictatorships. The Bible says that Europe is going to become a lot more authoritative. That's where this is leading. So this soon coming leader in Europe won't be democratic. How could that happen? Well, the Bible gives us more information. And it gives us that in Daniel chapter 11. And again, a lot of this chapter you can see in Daniel chapter 11 and verse 40, it says that this is for the time of the end. Just like Daniel chapter 8, it contains a long vision. It starts by talking about some things that happen anciently, and then it goes on to talking about modern events. But we'll look at a specific event in Daniel chapter 11, verse 30, or a specific instance in Daniel chapter 11 and verse 31. And here it is talking about something that happened anciently. It says an arm shall stand on his part. They shall pollute the sanctuary of strength and take away the daily sacrifice, and they shall place the abomination that makes desolate. So this is talking about a historical king, and it's very easy to see, especially when you include a lot of the other details around here, that this is talking about a Greek king of Syria called Antiochus Epiphanes. And the prophecies described here in Daniel chapter 11 match incredibly closely with the events of the reign of Antiochus Epiphanes. So much so that a lot of modern scholars say that the book of Daniel had to be written after Antiochus Epiphanes. They say, well, this is too accurate for it to be possible that Daniel wrote this in advance. Therefore, it must have been written afterwards. Now, there's a lot of evidence to prove that Daniel was written when he said he was written, when he said it was written, or when he says it was written in this book. But it's very clear that these events are talking about Antiochus Epiphanes, and it talks about this abomination that makes desolate. And we'll come back to Daniel 11, but if you look in Matthew 24 and verse 15, this is Jesus Christ, and he's answering the questions from his disciples, saying, well, when is your second coming happening? What is it going to be like at the end of the world, the end of this age? And Christ says in Daniel chapter 15, when you therefore see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet stand in the holy place, whosoever reads, let him understand. So at this point, Christ talks about the abomination of desolation, the same abomination, and he makes clear, mentioned by Daniel the prophet. But here, Christ is talking about it as something that would happen in the future. Historically, the events that Daniel talks about here happened in 168 BC. But Christ is talking about this abomination of desolation in the future. Well, how is that possible? Putting these two passages together, we can see that the ancient abomination of desolation is just a type of a future event. It happened anciently in 168 BC, but Jesus Christ is saying, well, it's also prophesied of a future event. A future abomination of desolation. The prophecy in this part of Daniel chapter 11 is dual. It applies to ancient Antiochus Epiphanes, but it prophesies also of a modern Antiochus. And we can rely on Jesus Christ's own statements in Matthew 24 to back that up. These prophecies are of a future event. So there's going to be a future Antiochus Epiphanes. And as this passage in Daniel chapter 11 brings out, this leader will attack Israel. And this passage in Daniel chapter 11 leads right on to the prophecies in Isaiah in Daniel 11 and verse 40 about this king of the north. This Antiochus Epiphanes rules the king of the north. This Antiochus and this Daniel 8 man are the same. There's a lot of similarities as you read these two. They're describing the same man. And Daniel chapter 11 also gives us some very important information about how this Daniel 8 man will come into power, how this end time Antiochus will come into power. And that's in Daniel chapter 11 and verse 21. And it says, in his estate shall stand up a vile person to whom they shall not give the honor of the kingdom, but he shall come in peaceably and obtain the kingdom by flatteries. Well, what does that mean? Well, we'll listen to a clip from a Key of David program. I think it was about nearly 10 years ago, but probably something like 8 or 9 years ago, from Mr. Flurry describing this verse and what it forecasts for Europe and Germany.
But here is a man that's about to come on the scene, and he's going to be more famous than Osama bin Laden or Ahmadinejad of Iran. A strong man is going to be brought on the scene in Europe, so says your Bible. Will an attack by Al-Qaeda provoke that? Well, I think it will. Or certainly could. I'll put it that way. It certainly could. But he's coming regardless. He's going to come on the world scene. And that European power is going to conquer the King of the South or radical Islam, including Iran and Al-Qaeda and other radicals. That is what your Bible says, and we have a booklet on the King of the South that proves that to you and others as well. In Daniel 11, there is an Antiochus talked about, and he is only a type of an end-time Antiochus that's talked about in Daniel 11 and Daniel 8, where he rises up before the world and just astounds everybody because he has all this power that is even there today in Europe, just waiting for some ruler to take control of it. Notice Daniel 11 and verse 21. And in his estate shall stand up a vile person, that's Antiochus, and even the history books will tell you that. And we have a booklet, The Middle East in Prophecy, that will also explain it to you. And all of our literature is free. And in his estate shall stand up a vile person to whom they shall not give the honor of the kingdom, but he shall come in peaceably and obtain the kingdom by flatteries. Now, he's not going to come in by, let's say, a democratic process. He's going to come in and use flatteries and sort of tweak the democratic process, it says here, something like that, and perhaps take advantage of a weak coalition. But he's going to come in by flatteries.
So that was, I think, 8 or 9 years ago, and Mr. Flo is talking about, well, he's going to come in, he's going to take advantage of a weak coalition. Well, what do we see right now in Germany? Jameson and Fawcett Brown, writing about this verse, they said that the nation shall not by a public act confer the kingdom on it, but he shall obtain it by artifice, flatterings. And you can look into what that Greek word flatterings means, but it's a kind of an illegitimate takeover. It's not a normal takeover, or it's not a being directly voted in. In our booklet, The Strong German Leader is Imminent, we wrote, we've said for years he won't be elected into office. And so we see now the German elections are setting exactly these conditions that are prophesied for this man to come into power. So that's what to watch for in Germany. And obviously we don't know exactly how, all the details. Maybe they would spend months and months. You could see how this could happen even potentially very quickly if they've got this coalition, no leader, and it drags on and you've got crises hit and people could decide, well, we need a strong man now. Or there will be just this weak coalition that you have that's divided between all these contradictory parties. And you could see that building this appetite for a strong leader. It could happen at a European level. We don't necessarily know all the details, but we're getting very close now to these prophecies being fulfilled. For more on this, read our free booklet, A Strong German Leader is Imminent. We'll take a quick break. When we get back, I'll get to that situation in Spain that I promised you at the beginning.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Herbert W. Armstrong described Germany's devastating destruction in 1944 and 1945 as one of the worst beatings ever administered to any nation. Western leaders from both sides of the Atlantic assured our peoples that a demoralized Germany would never again be able to disturb the peace of the world. But while Washington and London were promising that German militarism would never again be able to strike, Herbert Armstrong was warning the world of one final resurrection of a German-led Holy Roman Empire. Only a very few listened. Mr. Armstrong said German industry and the German people's willpower and determination to work, produce, and organize was the very heart and lifeblood of all Europe.
The nations of Europe want to unite. They just don't know how to do it.
He said the prostrate body of Europe could not come back without the leadership of a revived and vigorous Germany.
and the economic and the military body that is to rise up and to restore the Roman Empire. The thing that we least suspect here in the United States, it cannot rise up without its heart. And its heart is in Germany.
The world is witnessing history repeat itself one more time. Request Germany and the Holy Roman Empire for more on this important subject. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. This is Richard Palmer standing in for your regular host, Mr. Stephen Flurry. And before the break, we talked about how Germany is being paralyzed and is in no condition to deal with crises. We talked about what is prophesied for Germany. And as I said, to read more about that, and to really understand what's going on in Germany, get our book, The Strong German Lead, A Strong German Leader is Imminent. You can get that easily on our website. I'll probably put a link underneath this program, but also on the literature request tab up there. You can just click library and scroll down and find that book there. It really is your guide to what's happening in Germany and where this is leading, because there is great hope beyond where this is leading and this strong man that will rise up in Germany. But I'd like to talk to you now about a potential crisis that is building in Europe that you may not have heard about. One of the things that could be on a headless Germany's agenda, on the, its in tray very soon to deal with. These elections, as I said, they're going to make it hard for them to deal with crises. And so even, I'll just read a little bit more about these German coalitions, but with the Free Democratic Party in there, it could make it very difficult for them to deal with the euro crisis. And what's building in Spain could bring back the euro crisis very quickly. The FDP wants no debt forgiveness for any nation until they leave the euro, so it could really ratchet up the pressure on southern Europe. Apparently the French President Emmanuel Macron said that the FDP was part of the government, then he was dead. His words, that he'd be dead if Angela Merkel teams up with the FDP. So he's looking very worried, because it's going to make any kind of compromise or dealing with the migrant crisis very hard. But the crisis that's brewing at the moment is in Catalonia, this region of Spain where Barcelona is. It's in the northeast of Spain, kind of on the border with France there. And they want to be independent. Ambrose Evans-Pritchard had an article in The Telegraph where he kind of summarizes the situation. And he writes, while the EU watches in disbelief, a remote crisis has mushroomed suddenly into an existential crisis. You'll hear that phrase from a few different articles, by the way, but existential crisis for Europe. It is even more intractable than Brexit and certainly more dangerous. The volcanic events unfolding by the day in Catalonia threaten the EU project within its core. They pose a direct threat to the integrity of monetary union. Former French Premier Manuel Valls, son of a celebrated Catalan painter, warned that if this weekend's banned vote on independence goes ahead and leads to Catalan secession, it will be the end of Europe in a meaningful mission. So these are the kinds of problems Germany will be faced with. Like you heard there, they've got a vote on Sunday. Catalonia is Spain's richest region. And they've for a long time haven't had an independent streak, but since the 2008 financial crisis, that's gotten a lot stronger. You know, they subsidized the rest of the country, but because of the amount of money the government takes out of them, the regional government needed a bailout. That made them very unhappy, understandably. The regional government called for a referendum, a separatist party campaigned on a platform of holding a vote on referendum. Or holding a referendum. They won the election on that platform of holding a referendum. So they scheduled one. It's been delayed, but they've scheduled one for October 1st, for Sunday. However, the federal government has ruled the whole thing illegal. Separatism is not allowed in the Spanish constitution. Of course, constitutional law about independence. I mean, every independence ever was always illegal by some law, so it gets very complicated. But the federal government is now forcibly trying to stop this referendum. Going back to this article by Ambrose Evans-Pritchard, he wrote, those old enough to remember the Spanish Civil War can only shudder at TV footage of crowds across Spain cheering units of Guardia Civil as they leave for Catalonia, egged on with chants of go get them. As matters stand, 14 senior Catalan officials have been arrested. There have been dawn raids on the Catalan Generalitat, including the presidency and the economics ministry and the financial affairs office. Now, really, I think it was questionable whether the majority would vote yes in this referendum, but the really heavy-handed tactics by the government have blown this up. There's been a standoff across the region. The federal government, earlier in the week, for example, they were trying to unload some federal police at docks while the dock workers were blocking them and trying to prevent them from being unloaded. I think the federal police have been sent in and told to arrest people, found opening poll booths, to confiscate ballot papers, just do everything they can to stop this election. German Foreign Policy, they also had an article today pointing to just the danger of what is going on in Spain right now. It was by Jacob Shapiro. They write, ironically, Spain's crackdown, while predictable, exasperates the very threat Spain is trying to subdue. Whether or not Spain's heavy-handed approach prevents a declaration of independence in the long term, it will only push more Catalans towards the conclusion that their future lies not with Spain, but with themselves. Spain, the European Union's fourth largest economy, sits on the verge of a major political crisis that it has no way of solving. They give some background. They talk about how this standoff is only the latest expression of an issue between Madrid and Barcelona that is almost a millennium old, the Catalan people's desire to rule themselves. Present-day Catalonia has a culture, language, and history that is unique and all its own. It has preserved this identity despite losing multiple wars for self-rule and independence. It goes over some of that history and writes, with that in mind, Catalonia's referendum is an existential threat to Spain as we know it. They talk about how Spain has 19 autonomous regions of Catalan leaves. Then it says, well, not only would roughly 20% of Spain's economy disappear overnight, but it would also raise the possibility that other autonomous regions might be interested in a national self-determination too. You may remember, I think it was going back 10, 20 years ago, ETA, the Basque separatist group for the Basque region of Spain, was making news regularly for their attacks and calls for independence. Now, Spain has promised retribution if Catalonia does declare independence. They'll say if they end up with independence, then they'll make sure they get kicked out of the euro. But that would be crippling for Spain, too. This is Spain's richest, most economically dynamic region. Ambrose Evan Pritchard writes that the status of Spain's sovereign debt would be unclear. Why would the Catalans uphold their share of these liabilities if subjected to a boycott? Markets would have to presume that the debts of the Rump Kingdom would no longer be 99% of GDP, but more like 120%. So you'd have a jump in Spanish debt. And remember, Spain is one of those so-called pigs nations, the troubled nations in southern Europe that are challenged economically. So that would make, you could see an outbreak of the euro crisis very easily triggered by Spain leaving. Now, these protests, they're part of the same trend of anger and dissatisfaction all across Europe with the status quo. And again, now we're seeing, just as we talked about with Germany, you know, questioning democracy in Spain. Geopolitical Futures wrote, a spokesman for the Catalan government on September 25th described the Spanish government's most recent attempts to block the referendum as being no different from the ways in which the authoritarian regimes in China and North Korea govern their respective countries. This is an exaggeration. Catalan ministers aren't being executed by anti-aircraft batteries or facing a great proletariat cultural revolution. But the Spanish government is undeniably using force to prevent the referendum. And whether October 1st or sometime later, there is probably more violence to come. And this certainly ties in with the prophecies we were talking about in the first half of this program. This coming European power that the Bible says won't be democratic. This is part of the general political breakdown all across Europe. But it also ties into something else I was working on for the Trumpet print magazine this week, and that is the question of European identity. Europe is in a bit of an identity crisis right now. You know, they're asking, who am I? What is my place in the world? Just to read a couple of quotes from Samuel Huntington's book, Clash of Civilizations. He writes, you know, people are asking, who are we? And they are answering that question in the traditional ways people have always answered it, by reference to the things that matters to them most. Anyway, he talks about how in the post-Cold War world, these questions of identity are in flux. I'm skipping through some of this a little quickly. But people, they're asking, so for Catalonians, it's a question. Well, who am I? Am I Spanish or am I Catalonian? Or am I European? And all these identities overlap. So then the next question is, well, what's most important? Am I Spanish first and then Catalonian? Am I European first? You know, generally, those that consider themselves Catalonian also consider themselves European. European. They've appealed to the European Commission to stop the Spanish government and to play the role of a mediator. At the other end of the continent, the EU is having another problem with identity. George Friedman had an article this week on geopolitical futures talking about the major tension between the European Union and Poland. The EU doesn't like the new Polish government. They're trying to cut the EU funds that go to them. They write that Poland has elevated national distinctions to a level unacceptable to the European Union. It insists that there is a Polish nation and that others with differing values cannot become part of it. And Friedman writes further down, the Polish government represents a fundamental challenge to the EU. The EU promoted an ideology in which national distinctions were to subside and to be replaced by a European ideology. Since 2008, resistance to the priority of Europeanism over national identity has increased. That is what motivated Brexit. Poland and some other Eastern European countries have been particularly unwilling to abandon their national identity. And he said, for the EU, Poland and Hungary are mortal challenges. They have defined being European in a certain way. Poland and Hungary are reclaiming their right to their own national identity. The spread of the idea of national identity over EU values leaves the EU as an economic relationship, an elective affinity based on what the EU brings to the table. The EU is configured to judge its members. If the Polish and British disease spreads, the members will be judging the EU. So the EU is facing division at several levels. The EU has tried to make European identity supreme, but Poland is much more interested in a Polish identity, Hungary in a Hungarian identity, Catalonia is rejecting their Spanish identity and saying, well, no, we're Catalonians first, that's more important. Now, that's not incompatible with being European, but it's certainly causing division. So what can save Europe from all of these different divisions? Now, there are plenty of nations now looking at asserting their national identity above the EU. Political parties that want to do that. The Alternative for Deutschland in Germany. The National Fronts in France. True Finns in Finland. And then you've got all of these independence movements. You've got the Flemish in Belgium. And that's a major component of the Belgian political crisis, with people wanting Flemish independence. You've got the northern regions of Italy. Even in Germany, the Bavaria is talking about more independence. And there's a bit of a Bavarian independence movement. How can Europe avoid all of these different divisions, national, within nations, etc.? Well, attack from outside Europe is one powerful motivating force, but there's also another important factor that all European nations have in common, and actually something that generally those that talk about national identity and a difference from Europe, an identity that they promote, and that is Europe's Christian heritage. And you see across Europe all of these different powers, nations appealing to their Christian heritage, people using a Christian identity. There was an interview in The Atlantic that summed it up well. I think it was Rogers Brubacher, a sociologist at the University of California. And he said that it's a secularized Christianity as culture. It's a matter of belonging rather than believing. And that's a great way of putting it. For all of these parties across Europe, even in Poland, for the AfD, that they're talking about a Christian heritage, it's a matter of belonging rather than believing. They're not advocating Christian practice. Christians in Europe are not returning to church, but there's a lot more politicians talking about this. He says that we are Christians precisely because they are Muslims. Otherwise, we are not Christian in any substantive sense. That's what a lot of these national movements are appealing to. But it's something then that Europe could very easily adopt and will adopt to unite the continent as well. It's a force that can bring all of these different elements and these different national identities together. It's a force these national identities are already appealing to. And it's a force that transcends all of Europe. And it's something that, again, we've been forecasting for a long, long time. In 1978, Mr. Armstrong wrote that Europeans want their own united military power. They made a real effort through union in the common market, but they well know there is only one possibility of union in Europe, and that is through the Vatican. He talks about how Europe, he talks about all of the steps Europe had built, made towards unity, but he says there's only one way that the resurrected Holy Roman Empire that can be brought to fruition, and that is by the good offices of the Vatican. The only way it can come together. You can see that through all of the division that's spreading around Europe. But as I said, at the same time, all of these divided parties, they all have Christian heritage, Catholic heritage, from Catalan and Spain to Poland, and all of these parties that tend to want a certain national identity also draw very strongly on Christian heritage. And this is exactly what the Bible prophesies. Revelation 17 describes a woman that sits on many waters. Her power stretches over a huge part of the earth. And typically in the Bible, a woman represents a church. The kings of the earth, and it talks about how the kings of the earth have committed fornication with this woman, meaning she's a major political power. She rules over a beast, an empire, that's been resurrected several times. Now you can prove that this beast is the Roman Empire in John's day that's been resurrected continually. European leaders keep trying to bring this empire back. And it's still the case today. I saw a political cartoon the other week in The Telegraph showing Jean-Claude Juncker dressed as a Roman Empire, surrounded by Roman soldiers with EU flags hanging where the Roman flag or those Roman eagles would normally hang. And there's a lot of truth in that cartoon. It's easy to see that the European Union is an attempt to resurrect that Roman Empire. And this is a revived Roman Empire. And just as all so many of these revivals in history in places like with people like Charlemagne or Napoleon have been really strongly influenced and led by the Catholic Church, this modern resurrection of Europe will be as well. The Bible has a great deal to say about this European power that's rising. And so does history as well. And we've got a free booklet, The Holy Roman Empire in Prophecy, that puts all of this together. This will help you really understand what's going on in Europe. It proves so many of the prophecies of what will happen in Europe. Goes over why Mr. Armstrong wrote those forecasts so many decades ago and shows how so many of these prophecies have been fulfilled already. So request that booklet as well. You can do that at thetrumpet.com you can listen to more on our website, kpcg.fm. So keep tuning in, keep reading, and tune in next time for the Trumpet Daily Radio Show here on 101.3 on the FM dial.